Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, February 10th. I'm Lauren Schmidt reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Redway Business Park Cannabis and 3-acre farm approved. Eureka working on proposed homeless camping ordinance. And legislative briefing on government surveillance and civil rights in California. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. As first reported by our news partner, Redheaded Black Belt, a vehicle went over a 100-foot cliff near the Humboldt Bay South Jetty on Sunday, February 9th, just before 8 a.m. The crash occurred near South Jetty Road and Table Bluff Road, with two occupants inside the vehicle. The vehicle has been identified as a truck, though its make and model have not been released. According to emergency scanner traffic, one of the occupants, an injured woman, did not appear to have been wearing a seatbelt at the time of the accident. She was reportedly found in the back of the vehicle, suggesting that she may have tumbled inside during the crash. However, first responders noted that it was unclear whether the occupants had been driving when the truck went over the cliff. Rescue crews arrived at the scene and had to cut a path to reach the vehicle. One of the occupants was described as partially responsive, and a helicopter was used to evacuate one of the patients from the area. While the California Highway Patrol has not released additional information about the crash as of news time, the Ferndale Volunteer Fire Department provided an update on social media, describing the response as a challenging rescue operation on the South Jetty in Lolita. According to their statement, the Lolita Volunteer Fire Department was the primary agency responsible for the area. However, they requested mutual aid. Ferndale Fire responded and sent personnel with specialized equipment to assist in the effort. Two firefighters trained in rope rescue techniques rappelled down the steep embankment to assist medics already on scene, who were providing care to the two vehicle occupants. The difficult terrain and the precarious position of the victims made the rescue complex, requiring careful coordination between all responding agencies. Firefighters worked alongside medics to stabilize the injured individuals before carefully hoisting them down the cliff to an awaiting ambulance. Ferndale Fire concluded their statement by emphasizing the success of their operation, quote, "The outcome of this difficult rescue demonstrates the strong collaboration and training among the various agencies involved," end quote. You can see a photo of the rescue at kmud.org. The Mateel Community Center has announced the return of its Summer Arts and Music Festival, which has seen several venue changes in recent years. The event is now scheduled for the third weekend in June and will make its debut at the Southern Humboldt Community Park in Garberville. Last year, the festival returned to its roots at the Mateel Hall in Redway due to funding challenges, as the nonprofit had resurrected Reggae on the River, which had been on hold since 2018. The Mateel says they're excited to expand the 48th annual Summer Arts and Music Festival to this new Southern Humboldt location. In their statement, they said, quote, "It just feels right to bring together two of Southern Humboldt's best community assets, the Mateel Community Center and the Southern Humboldt Community Park, to expand this homegrown historical festival onto the beautiful grounds of this community gem," close quote. KMUD News reached out to the Mateel for further comment, and while they were unable to respond by deadline, they indicated more details would be available soon. You can read more about the 48th Annual Summer Arts and Music Festival at mateel.org. Humboldt County's Planning Commission has approved indoor cannabis cultivation in Redway and a 3-acre cannabis farm in Bloxburg. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
Allowing indoor cannabis operations within Humboldt County business parks is being done with, quote, surgical precision and being applied to 7 parcels in the Redway Business Park. The indoor cannabis production got unanimous approval of the county's planning commission at its February 6th meeting. The approval is for applying what's known as a Q-zone, qualified combining zone, to the Redway Business Park parcels, which total 8.6 acres. A concurrent amendment to the county's cannabis ordinance allows indoor cannabis in business parks with the Q-zone designation. Senior planner Stephen Santos told commissioners the Q-zone is being applied precisely and with conditions.
The Q qualified combining zone is very surgical. It only applies to 7 parcels within the business park. And in addition to the requirements of the CCLUO, permits for indoor cultivation within the Q would be subject to 8 performance standards relating to water, energy, and odor. And those specific performance standards are in the staff report as well as the ordinance.
It's not a controversial action. Santos said there have been no public comments, and the 7 parcels were chosen because they have existing Redway Community Services District water connections. The connections are included in the district's current water capacity study, he continued. During a public comment period, Southern Humboldt resident Bonnie Blackberry noted a requirement for adequate power and questioned whether PG&E's limited power availability in Soham will challenge compliance. The power situation was discussed in this exchange between Commissioner Peggy O'Neill and Planning Director John Ford.
It's a business park, so there's already PG&E there. They're just opening up an account. And so when it comes to PG&E, I don't think there's a shortage of power. I think that PG&E is not wanting to extend power too far off the existing grid at this time, like into areas where it isn't already there. But if it's already there, I don't think there's a shortage of power to hook up to it, right?
There is a shortage of power. But some parcels do actually have already the power right or the power extended and available at the parcel.
They just have to open an account. Yeah. And this is one that already has a connection.
At least one of them does, definitely. The others, that's why the performance standards exist.
Commissioner Noah Levy clarified that the Q-zone designation only makes the parcel owners eligible for indoor cannabis cultivation permits, and approvals are still required. Asked how many of the parcel owners are interested in permits, Santos replied, quote, at least one of them is. The Q-zone and ordinance change were unanimously approved. Also at the meeting, commissioners approved a conditional use permit for a new 3.1-acre mixed-light cannabis farm in the Blocksburg area, about 3.5 miles south of the Goldridge Lane and Alder Point Road intersection. The project consists of 38 greenhouses, a drying barn, 3 permitted wells with 250,000 gallons of hard tank water storage, and a commercial-scale cannabis processing facility. County Planner Rodney Yandell noted that the project parcel is rather large, over 1,800 acres, and though some wetlands and grassy areas will be impacted, restoration is at 3-to-1 and 2-to-1 ratios. The permit includes numerous mitigation measures, he continued. Praj White of North Point Consulting Group, the project's consultant, summarized the project's history and it's downscaling from an original plan.
The project originally was proposed at 12 acres, using that very large project area that you saw and taking advantage of that original ordinance language. The applicants spent tons of money, tons of studies, looked all over the property, and were headed towards EIR for the project. And then hence the extensiveness of the studies and the background that you see. There was some frustration on the applicant's part with moving this through. We ended up chatting with them, finding that, you know, there were, it was a significant project and reaching up on the ridge and then spread out all over that property. So we worked with the applicant to talk about what's really important. We worked with staff about what the issues are and the areas of impact. And we identified that concentrating the project only on this meadow that's right next to Alder Point Road has a history of being old horse racetrack and been used for grazing and cattle operations for years and years, made the most sense for the application. The applicant was happy to reduce their application.
Commissioner Levy noted there's been no public comment which, quote, speaks to how well planned this project has been. The permit was unanimously approved. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Encampments are growing in Eureka's green spaces, and the City Council is working on an unauthorized camping ordinance aimed at balancing social service needs with the broader community's concerns. KMUD's Kelly Lincoln brings you the details.
The City of Eureka is working to reframe and restart its unauthorized camping ordinance based on the LEAD model, which stands for Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. On background, in June of last year, in a case called Grants Pass versus Johnson, the United States Supreme Court ruled that local governments can prohibit camping on public property without violating the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment, even if there are no alternative shelters available. The court ruled, in essence, that the Eighth Amendment prohibits the method of punishment a government may use, but it does not impose limits on the actions a state may criminalize. The court's dissenting opinion was strong in its opposition to this finding. It opens, quote, "Sleep is a biological necessity, not a crime. For some people, sleeping outside is their only option." Meanwhile, in Eureka, the trash and unkempt nature of homeless encampments in the green spaces has the community upset.
"We are currently members of Volunteer Trail Stewards and Packout Green Team. We are discouraged and disheartened by what we see on a daily basis. Our forests, wetlands, and waterfronts are being decimated and polluted by illegal campers. Native trees are denuded for campfires and burned when fires become out of control. Stealing and drug use are rampant, making residents scared to enjoy the outdoors."
The City of Eureka seeks to develop an ordinance that avoids punishing people for poverty but addresses the issues at hand. On January 14th, the council held a special meeting to take input from city staff on how to develop such an ordinance. Police Chief Brian Stevens says there are different responses from the campers they interact with.
"But there are three groups of people that we deal with, and that is the have-nots, and that is our individuals like we talked about that something's happened in their life, right? They lost their job during COVID. They found themselves now to become homeless. Those are the ones that are seeking out whatever resources we can give them. They want off the street. Then we have our cannots, right? Those are our individuals. Those are our community members who are the most vulnerable, who have the mental health issues that are so high they can't function in society. That's where CARE, that's where CSET, that's where we're coming in right now and trying to address those on the street level. They're on the street addressing those issues every single day. And then we have our will-nots. The will-not is the criminal element that is going after the most vulnerable people in our community. Just this last couple weeks ago, we had a major incident happen in front of Freemail, and it had to do with one will-not in that community of can-nots and have-nots down there that almost got somebody killed."
Jacob Rosen supervises Eureka's social services programs.
"This sort of programming really plays to Eureka Police Department's strengths in community policing. CSET is already doing a tremendous amount of work in this direction, and giving them an extra tool, it'll help leverage relationship building, because we can work with these folks and provide support at the same time of holding accountability for inappropriate behavior. And essentially the way that it reads is that low-level offenses still have reports taken and charges are still filed, but the city attorney holds or suspends that case until the individual's had an opportunity to work with Uplift or CARE. And work on developing a plan in favor of then being able to eventually drop that charge. Once the goals are completed, the paperwork is then forwarded to the city attorney and EPD, closing that case out. If the individual does not participate in the program, the idea would then be once the time elapses that those charges are pushed forward for that accountability component."
Chief Stevens describes the flexibility involved in using such a program rather than citing people under existing laws.
"There are a multitude of laws that are being violated in some of those photos you've seen and a lot of the interactions that we have. A lot of those are misdemeanor, soon to be could be felony under Prop 36. Some of those are fish and game violations that are already felony violations that we can deal with. I think, like Sergeant Omi explained, without a lot of the avocation that could take place because those are going to the district attorney's office, we can make those arrests. We can file those cases. We can send them up. Then it's in the court's hands at that point. It's in the judge's hands at that point and what the DA wants to do with the case. There are people who need to have certain amounts of attention to change behavior. There are people that need to have assistance, and they can't find that assistance on their own, but we can use the system to our advantage to find that assistance for them. When we send it to the DA's office, when it gets in Superior Court, it's a completely different animal. The city attorney doesn't have the same purview over the case and the investigation or in the prosecution of it, and it really takes away what we can do. Then if there is an opportunity for us after someone has been prosecuted, it's like Sergeant Omi said, we have to really advocate to get charges dropped. We have to do a longer process to try to take advantage of a circumstance that may come up, like they can be rehoused with family members. But if they can't leave the county because they're on probation now because their case got prosecuted, then that's a whole different set of circumstances we have to deal with before we can try to help.
Longtime homeless warrior Nezzy Wade commended Eureka's efforts in social services. However, she says the city has three programs that involve the police.
What about adding other components that increase the possibilities that people are not always interacting with the police? They're interacting with other people, like in our space, or in some of, like, Leslie, you understand from having Synapsis, having an opportunity for people to come and not have that interaction. I firmly believe, as Carolyn mentioned, there's not a lot to be gained by increasing the level of crime to be able to work with people. It's going to put them farther away and farther out of the ballpark for a lot of things like housing and other opportunities.
And longtime homeless outreach coordinator John Shelter spoke about the downsides of the ordinance in light of the fact the city doesn't provide legal camping options.
My concern is when we start pushing harder on city properties and stuff, where are these individuals going to end up? Private properties? Business owners' properties?
One woman who has been homeless explained what she had needed and recommended legal camping be developed.
When I was stuck car camping, the only places we were legally permitted to park overnight were very far from any publicly available 24-hour bathroom. This meant driving to Winco or Walmart in the dead of the night, often exhausted and sleep-deprived, sometimes with an officer telling us we needed to move. I'm not surprised at the lack of available space, showers, or restrooms that folks needing to car camp between leases and homes who are also employed at local businesses may find it hard making their shift on time or well-groomed. After witnessing this meeting, I'm really impressed with the progress, and I'm happy to see housing and support programs expanded.
An ordinance is currently being drafted by Eureka City staff and will be presented to the City Council in the coming weeks. This is Kelly Lincoln reporting for KMUD.
In state news, the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, a nonprofit organization dedicated to defending civil rights and freedoms, will hold a press conference tomorrow at the California State Capitol. The event will feature a legislative briefing on government surveillance and civil rights in California. The briefing, which is open to the public, will include panelists such as a former FBI special agent, representatives from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and other experts in privacy and civil liberties. To better understand the importance of this event and its implications for civil rights, we spoke with George Perampathu.
I'm a legislative attorney with ACLU California Action, and I generally cover criminal justice and police practices issues.
On Tuesday, February 11th, from 1 to 2 p.m., the ACLU will present key findings on government surveillance and its impact on civil rights, including its intersection with technology and law enforcement. The briefing aims to provide California legislators, their staff, and the public with critical insights into government surveillance practices, gaps in digital privacy protections, how these vulnerabilities enable attacks on civil rights, and actionable steps for the California legislature.
Last year, we saw a couple debates in the legislature about things like facial recognition technology for police or allowing police to stick guns on robots. And so when we were having those debates in the legislature, we found that a lot of people, staffers and members alike, were not well versed in the sort of privacy issues that come with sticking cameras everywhere. And so we thought it'd be good before this session starts to put out an educational briefing for members, staff, committee consultants to come together and learn more about our view of privacy issues.
The event will take place near the California State Capitol in Sacramento. It is intended to inform lawmakers about the dangers of unchecked surveillance and to push for stronger legal protections.
The topics we're going to be covering are what surveillance technology is watching us without us knowing, where does all that information go, who has access to it, and what the legislature can do to protect us and our information.
As for which surveillance technologies raise the most concerns, he says,
I don't want to give too much away from the briefing, but one thing I will highlight is what are called fusion centers. These are black box information gathering and sharing sites between the federal government, state government, and local government. These were created post 9/11, and there are six of them in California. This is the most of any state. They barely exist in the California code. They barely exist in state budget documents, but they certainly are found in San Diego, Orange County, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and then there are two in Sacramento. And they are spying on all of us.
According to the Department of Homeland Security, fusion centers serve as state-run intelligence hubs that collect, analyze, and share information about threats. They connect local police, state agencies, federal agencies, such as the FBI and DHS, and private companies. Originally created after 9/11 to combat terrorism, fusion centers now monitor a broad range of activities, including cybercrime, organized crime, drug trafficking, and even protests and civil unrest. Tomorrow's briefing will feature three experts in data privacy and civil rights, including representatives from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Catalyst California, the ACLU, and a former government official turned activist.
There's Mike German, as you mentioned, former FBI special agent. He's also currently a privacy fellow for the Brennan Center of Justice. So he'll be there to tell us the truth about fusion centers and also will be available to answer any questions anyone in the audience might have. You will really have your mind blown. If you apply AI to it to do things like facial recognition technology, it gets dystopian very quickly.
The ACLU is encouraging members of the public to contact their state representatives and urge them to attend the briefing, as lawmakers are returning to the Capitol, making this an opportunity for the public to push for stronger privacy protections.
This is 100% open to the public. Everybody who RSVPs at our RSVP link will be sent the live stream link and the location. As you noted, tomorrow's briefing will be within the Capitol in Sacramento. Other audience members will include legislative members, legislative staffers. In the legislature, there are policy committees. There will be consultants from those committees will also be there. Outside of Coastal Community Radio, there will also be other media members present. And we hope to have plenty of members of the public as well.
KMI News will provide coverage on the event and share highlights on a later newscast. We will also post the audio in full at kmud.org following the briefing.
Yeah, what I would say to everybody listening is that in the legislature, these technology companies are a very loud voice. They will never stop asking for more of your information, and they will never stop asking to try to sell their technology to government agencies, including police departments. With that in mind, it is important to be an individual informed citizen so that you can have your voice raised in the legislature as well. I will say that if you were to call your state senator or state assembly member, they would be very responsive. These members love to hear from their constituents, and they are just waiting for people to make their voices heard on issues that matter to them. And so if something comes up in this briefing or you see something in the news that causes you concern, I would strongly encourage you to reach out to your assembly member or your senator, because they are wanting to hear from you.
For more information on the legislative briefing on government surveillance and civil rights in California, you can visit the ACLU's website, That's ACLU CalAction.org. In national news, Senate confirms Vought to head OMB as Democrats blast him for making Project 2025 into Trump's agenda. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
As government offices go, the Federal Office of Management and Budget has never been very high profile, and the OMB director has rarely been a household name. But nowadays, the Office of Management and Budget has become the spearhead of President Donald Trump's plans to restructure government, fire thousands of federal workers, and dismantle entire agencies. So when Trump's pick to head the office, Russell Vought, came up for confirmation in the Senate, it was a fierce 30-hour partisan debate. Republican John Thune of South Dakota is the Senate Majority Leader.
Mr. President, as Director of OMB, Mr. Vought will have the chance to address two key economic issues, cutting burdensome government regulations and addressing excessive spending.
He says Vought will lead the charge to cut regulations and government waste. Democrats, on the other hand, had a different view of the nominee.
He is Donald Trump's most dangerous nominee.
Jeff Merkley is a Democrat from Oregon. He says Vought is not as well known as other Trump nominees, but perhaps he should be.
This man, who is the chief engineer of the Trump train, a train that plans to disregard the law and the Constitution, that is a bigger danger to our republic. And that is why Democrats are taking the floor now and will continue to hold the floor over the every minute allowed under our rules to say this is a mistake.
Trump's pick for budget chief, Russell Vought, is the only person nominated for the same position he held in the first Trump administration. He's known as a staunch fiscal conservative. He's described himself as a Christian nationalist. And he's also a key author of the controversial presidential transition plan known as Project 2025. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York led Democrats in a 30-hour marathon of opposition intended to show how Vought is, in Schumer's words, turning Project 2025 into the White House agenda.
With Vought, who was one of the chief architects of Project 2025, as head of OMB, all of it, much of it, damaging, dangerous for the American people, will be implemented. And that's why Americans do not want Russell Vought, the author of 2025, to head such an all-powerful, all-encompassing agency as OMB.
Democrat Patty Murray of Washington says Vought's game plan is to break the law and then dare the world to stop him.
A post-constitutional time? That's what he believes we're in. Do my colleagues agree with that? Do they think it's time to shred the Constitution? That is what is at stake with this confirmation Vought. Because Vought has made it all too clear that as OMB director, he will put everything on the chopping block, from programs that people rely on to the checks and balances our democracy is founded on.
Democrats continue the debate through the night and into the next day. But when the Vought came, Vought was confirmed in a party line Vought of 53-47. So that's done. But that does not mean it's over, at least not according to Murray.
Make no mistake, this fight is not over. As I said before, we still have a lot of work to do right now to make sure all that funding actually does get moving again. This is not like turning on a light switch.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Kelly Lincoln, and Christopher Martinez. KMOD News is online. You can find us on KMOD.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Or send us an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.